The play's the thing today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Playwright Sarah Rule's work has been nominated for Pulitzers and a Tony. We nominate her as our guest today on Scribble. One would guess, just from your record of accomplishment, that you were born to be a writer, a playwright. And now you tell me you're a poet as well.
Well, I started off writing poems, actually, from a young age. And then I got sucked into the vortex of the playwriting world around when I was in my early 20s.
That's interesting that, you know, so many people we've talked to who are writers started at an early age. What is it? What was the compulsion? What made you start writing?
It's like an itch that you have to scratch, I guess. You know, from an early age, I was always, speaking of scribbling, I was always scribbling something or other. And I think it's a way of observing the world.
Mm-hmm. But poetry was the beginning.
Yep.
And now you have a book of poetry coming out?
Finally, at the age of 45, I have a book called 44 Poems for You. And so I guess I average out a poem a year.
Have you written them, like, at that rate? Or
no.
Have you returned to poetry now recently? Or?
Well, some of them are older poems, but I've always written poems, and I just haven't published them. I sort of think of them as secret Valentines in my secret cubby of my desk drawer, and I write them usually for people or occasions or just because I have to. And my husband encouraged me to not be such a hoarder and to share them.
Well, what moved you toward the theater?
Mm.
That's not an obvious choice, I think, for a writer.
Well, in many ways, it was growing up around the theater because my mom, Kathy Rule, who's from Davenport, Iowa, she acted in plays when I was little and directed them, and I would always be in the back in the rehearsal in the dark taking notes and watching. So the theater world was really seemed normal to me, seemed part of life to me from a young age. And then, but I didn't consider writing a play. And then it was when I was at college, I met this teacher, Paula Vogel, who's an incredible playwright, and she really encouraged me to shift over from poetry to playwriting.
You did some work for a group, was it Piven, P-I-V?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And looking up, you know, what you had accomplished, I noticed that you started out writing plays from books, from stories, and you did a number of them for this theater. How did that association come about, and how did the motivation to do this come about?
Well, I guess I was interested in taking acting lessons, and this woman, Joyce Piven, is quite an amazing acting teacher, and a lot of her students have gone on to, you know, fame and fortune, like John Cusack and Lily Taylor, and then, of course, her son, Jeremy Piven, and her daughter, Shira Piven. But I loved improvising. I think I loved the moment of creation more than I loved when the audience came, which I think is a pretty good sign that you're a writer and not a performer. And she did, she and her husband, Byrne, did this method called story theater where they would take, a short story, a Kurt Vonnegut or fairy tales and perform them using the narration in the performance. And I think the effect it had on me was realizing that you weren't bound to realism in the theater, that it could be a literary enterprise and you could use all of the bounty that prose gives you. You're not obligated to just have dialogue.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that impressed me is looking back to this play you wrote or was produced in 2003 called Eurydice. And I think what caught my attention was the fact that the legend of Orpheus and Eurydice, when he goes to the underworld to bring her back, and he turns and looks at her, and so she can't leave. You did something that the Greek playwrights would often do. Mm-hmm. You added another character.
Uh-huh.
You added Eurydice's mother, who was in the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the business of her turning back changed.
Mm-hmm. I'm so interested that you noticed that about adding a character, and that the idea that, you know, if you look at one mythos that Euripides and Sophocles and Aeschylus all treat, that they do something different, and often it's the addition of a character. And in my case, I wrote that play not long after my father died, and in some ways the play was a way of having more conversations with him. So in the play, it becomes almost a love triangle between Orpheus, Eurydice, and her father. She meets her father in the underworld and has conversations with him and relearns her memory, and then it becomes a more active choice about whether to follow Orpheus out of the underworld.
Pardon me, I thought it was the mother, but
that's
it's
right.
The father?
Yeah.
It was the father.
Yeah.
And it's Eurydice's choice not to go back.
Yeah.
That is fascinating.
Well, I feel like she's always this cipher, and she's just this sort of shade who dies twice. And I was really interested in her point of view. And the other thing I added was that before Orpheus turns around, she says his name, and it startles him, and that's what makes him turn. And I guess I was really interested in the idea that Orpheus represents music and that she represents language. So in my version, she's interested in books, she's interested in writing, and Orpheus is the wordless music.
Mm-hmm. But it was by calling him, she is the one who initiated the fact that she would stay in the underworld with her father.
Yeah.
That's a nice twist. Yeah, when you do, we do Greek plays every year, mm-hmm. and look at the different approach to Electra, for example, mm-hmm. between Euripides and Sophocles.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's to add a wrinkle, that's the new thing. But of course, you've had great success. You've had two nominations for Pulitzers, one for Tony,
and a MacArthur Fellowship.
Oh, the
genius!
Yeah.
How did that come? I mean,
oh gosh,
that's amazing. I don't think I've ever met somebody who actually got one of these awards.
Well, that award is the best award because they give you money for
right.
one thing, and they don't. There are no strings attached. So
But you're not nominated for it or anything,
well,
are you?
Well, you don't know. It's all
no.
under a veil of secrecy,
right.
so you don't even have to go through disappointment
right.
if you don't get it. It just comes out of the clear blue sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. You wonder where you have to be visible to catch their eye.
You don't know, and probably it's a network of your supporters and friends and colleagues who have...
Do they tell you why, or do they just...
No.
Give you...
It's all secret. And so I remember when I got it, I had a small baby, and I was driving to I was strolling her to the pharmacy in New York, and I got this phone call, and it was a 312 number, and I of course was immediately nervous because my family's in Chicago, and it looked like, oh, could that be a hospital? Like, who's calling me on my cell phone with a 312 number? And I also was nervous because they said, is this Sarah Rule? Can you sit down? I thought, oh, dear God, what's happened? And I couldn't sit down. I could only kind of
right.
lean against a urine-soaked wall, you know, where I was in New York. And they said, you've won the MacArthur. And then they kind of say, you'll never hear from us again.
Right.
We'll route this money into your bank account. It's like being James Bond or something. You know?
That is amazing.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you
have any idea why you won it?
I suppose they must have read my plays.
I know, but what? I mean, other playwrights write plays too.
Yeah.
But you, I mean, you had really astounding success as a playwright.
I was really lucky to get noticed early on in my career, and I don't know how to account for it.
I actually knew someone who was on the committee.
You did?
Yeah, I found out. That he was on the MacArthur Awards Committee. And I thought, I must not have passed muster. But you never know what prompts them to come up with a... And now you make me nervous, because when I get 312 calls, I don't answer them. But I'm well past MacArthur status.
Oh, you never know. It's never too late.
Oh, yeah. It's... once you're as old as I am, I think your chances of doing new work are kind of limited. But you still have a lot in front of you. Are you working on a play now?
I am. I'm working on a comedy about the Salem witch trials.
The what?
The Salem witch trials.
A comedy on the Salem. Okay, all right. You're right. You can do anything.
So what makes you decide? I mean, this is a good example. Mm-hmm. What precipitated this play?
Well, so this, I saw The Crucible on Broadway, right. And it was a kind of sexy production, and the young girls were more sexualized than usual. And I was thinking, what is this? What is going on in this play? Because I'd always thought of it as a parable about McCarthyism. And then I realized it really was a story about a young girl with lust for this older man who then revenges herself right. on him by this mass hysteria and manipulated hysteria. And I thought, well, this is kind of hard to take that Miller blames the whole witch trial tragedy on the lust of a young girl. It probably can't be true. And then I did a little digging historically. And in fact, Abigail Williams, who's the young girl, she was 6 years old historically. And John Proctor, who she was supposed to be in love with, was 60. So clearly this never happened unless it was a case of abuse. So I wanted to offer some different explanation for the hysteria.
Well, I imagine when Miller wrote the play, he took liberties.
He did. And what was really mischievous about Miller is he took liberties, but he didn't say what was fact and what was fiction. So he has copious detailed notes about the real history. So you think you're watching a history play, and you're not really aware of what's filtered out.
I know I saw the movie Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Peter O'Toole, just the perfect hero and so on. It's had his flaws, but wonderful character. Then I read a biography.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence spent most of his time in Arabia being sick.
Oh.
He had saddle sores, so he couldn't ride a camel. I mean, it was just... you know, when you look at how that play was put together, it was masterfully done,
mm-hmm.
but it was not reality.
At all,
and
yeah.
you kind of wish that it had been reality.
Yeah.
But that's the danger when you write about something in the past. Mm-hmm. That if you tell a story, people are going to take that story as fact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's said nowadays, you know, when we have all our arguments and politics mm-hmm. and so on, once somebody accepts a story or adopts a faith, you can't change them with facts. You have to tell them a different story.
I love that idea. That's fantastic.
Yeah. You have to tell them a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you do. You're telling different stories.
That's right.
Be careful with this enormous power.
Let's talk about the nitty-gritty for a minute of getting plays produced. It seems to me you've got a much harder job than a poet does. A poet writes a poem and he's a poet, or mm-hmm. she's a poet, right? But you have to have somebody produce this play, and you have to have actors to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the whole process is partly out of your control.
Yes.
How does one... I mean, use one of your plays as an example. How do you go about getting a play produced?
So early on, it's very hard. And you know, in terms of encouraging young writers, my play Eurydice, which we talked about, had 13 stage readings before ever getting done. So, for example, I would send 10 plays out a week,
okay.
or maybe a month. I'd wait for them right. to get rejected. 10 copies of one play, I should say, to 10 different theaters. And then the rejections would come in, and then I would send them to the next 10 theaters. So I got very friendly with my postman or postwoman. This was before you could submit plays through email. And so I would get these stage readings where theater would say, well, we want to hear the play out loud. And I would be invited, and it would go well. And I would think, great, like, when are you going to produce it? And they would shake my hand and send me on my way. So this happens a lot in the theater world, where you need to get to know the people at the theaters, and they watch your work for a while and follow you before they produce your play. So in the early years, it was a lot of traveling, a lot of meeting people. They want to make sure you're not crazy, you know, that you'd be okay to work with.
Does that make a difference?
Whether or not you're crazy. So,
at what point did you get an agent and how?
I got my first agent, I think he came to see a reading of an adaptation I did of a Virginia Woolf novel, Orlando, and he left at the intermission. I thought, oh, God, I guess he hated it. And then he wrote me the next day and said, I'm sorry I left early. My kid had a soccer game. I'd love to represent you.
Oh.
So that's how it went. But I guess I would encourage would-be playwrights to look at the dramatist source book. It's a great Bible for anyone writing plays. It tells you where to submit to agencies, how to submit to theaters. It's got some really great practical advice.
The problem is agents get a lot of submissions, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, as I know that's true of in fiction. We interviewed somebody whose agent the previous week had gotten 1,000 emails.
Oh, my God.
From would-be writers.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many people, you know, searching, and it's very difficult to do.
Yeah.
But once you have scored a production and some success, then the path gets easier, doesn't it?
It gets a little easier, yeah.
So you turn from that to poetry. Can you read us one of your poems?
Sure, I'd love to. This one I wrote a while ago, and it's for my father. It's called Driving to Iowa on Christmas Eve. The last time we drove to Iowa before my father died, he and my mother sat in the front, my sister and I in the back, our heads rolling onto each other's shoulders, two stalks with buds too big for standing. The warm car in the cold air looks out on purple fields of snow-blanketed corn. The night is the color of a lavender mussel, and we are the fruits of enclosure. A dark, soundless mussel, yards below water, inside the walls of a domed shell. My father looks straight into the road that keeps replacing itself, looks at the shadows of corn he used to detassel in the summer, his innocent hands helping the shy boy and girl corn to mate. The sky is hot and golden as young corn in heat. He drives straight into the vertebrae of the country, straight into this Midwest with its prolonged childhood and reams of sky, while his family tastes the last sleep drawn from the comfort of this configuration of going home. The father is driving, the mother is in front, the two sisters are in back, sleeping.
Ooh,
very nice.
What's the name of this book going to be?
44 Poems for You.
Okay, and I'm sure it'll be available at Barnes & Noble's and Books a Million here.
Don't look at me. I don't
know.
It should be, yeah.
Yeah, it should be. Why not? Yeah.
Well, you do have a rather magical name still in this area.
Oh.
You know?
I'm related to a lot of folks.
Rules.
Well, yeah, rules. You are. Yeah. I remember trying to sell an advertising gadget to the rural agency. It was one of the more embarrassing moments of my life. I was thinking of little gadgets that they might like, and I remembered seeing in my catalog a ruler.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned it, and the man at the desk says, "Now, that's a good idea. What do they look like?" And I could not find a picture of the bloody thing. It just drove. And so I did not make a sale.
Let's go back for a minute to producing a play. Once a play gets accepted by a director or a theater, how much say do you have? How much rewriting are you allowed to do or asked to do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you watch productions of it and change lines? And
For a premiere, for sure, all of that. So you would have approvals over the director and the designers and the actors. You couldn't stipulate who you want to be in the play, but you for sure have veto power. And then you're in the room and you're doing rewrites and you're listening to the actors and you're listening to the music of how they're delivering the lines, you're making cuts, little changes. And then in previews in New York, they have a period right after dress rehearsal. You have performances for the public before the critics come. And that's your chance to hear how it lands on an audience's ears. Mm-hmm. And you hear immediately when you've hit a boring spot or where people aren't laughing.
That's easier to hear produced rather than sitting writing it.
Yes, absolutely. And then you make little adjustments until opening.
Now, Eurydice has been turned into an opera.
Mm-hmm.
What was your involvement in that?
Well, I wrote the libretto. So It's mostly a distillation of the play. I mean, it's because opera, you know, it's so distended, so it takes so long to sing a phrase. I probably had to cut, I don't know, mm-hmm. at least 50% of the words in the play to make it singable. And then I versified some things and changed some little things so that it was more easily sung.
But did you do this and then you gave it to the composer and then he took it from there?
No, a composer came to me wanting to work on it, and then we worked together back and forth.
Do I understand that an early thing you did of Orlando, was that made into an opera as well?
No, there is an Orlando opera, but I didn't write that one.
Okay. So do you know when this opera will be presented?
Yes, it's going to be at the LA Opera next February. And then hopefully the Metropolitan Opera the following year.
No kidding.
It's crazy.
Wow.
I'm going to have to buy a new dress for that one.
Sarah, I mean, you have the touch. Obviously, you are in the right field.
Oh, thank you.
That's just amazing. What's your next play going to be?
My next one.
Oh, you talked about the... this making a comedy of the Salem witch trial. But is that it, or do you have something else in the works?
Well, I'm contemplating. I have this book that was a collaboration with my student, Max Ripfo, who was a poet at Yale, and he died of cancer 3 years ago. And we have a book of letters together called Letters from Max. And a couple of people have asked, would I be interested in turning that into a play? So I'm thinking about doing that.
And that, I have, what is the play? I've seen something like that consists of letters.
Oh, I wrote a play called Dear Elizabeth. That's letters between Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell.
Uh-huh.
But there are a lot of great letters plays.
Yeah.
Love letters.
Letter writing is almost a lost art these days.
Mm-hmm.
You have to raid a computer to find letters.
That's right.
But... So you have one play. How far along is the comedy on the Salem Witch Trial?
I finished it. I probably could use some rewrites, but I'm sort of ready to go into production with it.
How much rewriting do you do?
I tend not to change huge structural things once I'm in rehearsal. It tends to be a little bit more moment-to-moment work.
Do you, as you write a play, do you discover things about your character that you didn't know at the beginning?
Oh, absolutely.
And then does that go back and change the beginning then sometimes?
Sometimes I feel like the beginning is this horrible scaffold that or ladder that you're pulling up behind you, because it's true. I don't know what I know at the end of the play at the beginning. And so sometimes I find the first scenes really tricky and I have to go back in and try to change them. But by then they feel... like they're sort of set in some kind of paint that's already dried, and it's hard to change those first scenes.
But then once an actor or an actress takes over, that happens again, doesn't it? Because
mm-hmm.
because who your lines and whoever says those lines is a collaboration.
Absolutely.
That you couldn't have planned.
Yeah, and sometimes you want to tailor that role to them like a bespoke
right.
suit. So you want it to feel good on them.
Have you ever seen a production of a play where you objected to how it was treated?
I have a pretty funny experience in Germany with my play Eurydice. They tend to change a lot in Germany and not really be that on the mark with the text. So they'd cut monologues of Orpheus and replace them with Heiner Müller text. And they had they're all wearing clown makeup and it was very long. So that was sort of a Pandora's box that I shut, and I stopped going to plays when I wasn't terribly involved with them.
I wonder how an author feels about that. You turn a play over to a director, and directors can do strange things sometimes. Does that bother you?
Yes. Yes. It's a very lonely feeling.
Well, you don't have any recourse there, do you?
Well, and then in the States, you know, you have your, the Dramatists Guild, and they really can't change your text. So in Germany, that was a little outside the norm. So you have the guild, and, you know, honestly, people do respect playwrights in the room here, and they do listen to your wishes. So particularly on a premiere, I've never had a bad experience with a director not listening to me.
Yeah, well, I've seen Shakespeare pulled and tugged into all sorts of shapes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them so bizarre, you know, you think we just lost the play.
Mm-hmm.
But are your plays, you know, you must keep track of how often they're performed and how widespread they are. Do they have pretty good circulation?
Mm-hmm. My mother keeps track. Yeah.
Are any of your plays in print? So that somebody could buy?
Yes, you can. You can go to Amazon and get them. There's a volume called The Clean House and Other Plays that I recommend partly because it has four plays in one. So if you want to read a bunch of plays for the same price.
Okay, and that title is again?
The Clean House and Other Plays.
Okay.
Now, to get down to the business of money, how do you earn money from writing plays?
Well, there are a couple ways. One is the royalties. So you have a portion of the box office when they're done.
Is it a portion of the box office or a flat fee?
It's a flat fee if it's licensed to colleges or, you know, non-professional theaters. But if it's a professional theaters, you get a percentage of the box office. And then commissions, so someone asking you to write a play. And grants and prize money. And then, you know, most playwrights I know either teach, which I do at Yale School of Drama, or they write for TV and film to support their playwriting habit.
Well, the reason I ask that is because I remember a very funny thing by Dave Barry.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about poets, you know, who make 80% of the money that's made in writing, and they drive expensive cars and so on. Making fun of the fact that poets don't make any money at all. And I just wondered, is it necessary for even for an author of plays to have separate employment?
Yes, almost always. There are very few. You sort of count on one hand the playwrights who can support themselves solely through the theater. But I will say, so Paula Vogel, who was my mentor at Brown, she took the graduate students up to her house in Cape Cod one time, and she had just won the Pulitzer Prize for How I Learned to Drive. And she said, "Now, ladies, I want you to look at this view of the ocean. It's a beautiful view. And say to yourselves, this is what playwriting can buy." She had just bought a house with her earnings from that play. So it can happen.
It can happen, but generally it's like anything else. I know when you author a book, unless it's a runaway bestseller, I know someone who had 20 some books in print, and she was living from hand to mouth.
It's the same. It's sort of feast or famine in that way.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, Sarah, I must say it's been a pleasure to visit with you.
And likewise.
You have had a wonderful career, and I think onward and upward from this point.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Rule's been our guest today on Scribble. Rule Tweet and I will be back next week as we continue slogging on with another Scribble. Join us.